monster from his lab began to rise. And suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires.
You know what I love when people try to tell me why I like things? Like,
yes.
I'm engaged in some sort of Twitter debate, and they're trying to tell me why I like Joss Whedon. So,
do you like Joss Whedon?
I mean, he's okay. I was also accused of not liking Chris Claremont because I don't like strong women. So,
what do you have against strong women, Seth?
I don't know. Apparently, I'm sexist.
Turn into a little Sunday morning shrink session here.
Yeah.
Tell me, how does that make you feel, Seth?
Pretty awful right now. I hate myself.
Welcome to the Bigfoot Show.
Yeah, it's a dream.
Have you been on the Bigfoot Show before? We've done this, but I've done it the other way around, right? I was on Sasquatch. We've never done it this way.
Yeah, I've never been on this show, which got me into Bigfooting to begin with.
Wow. I'll tell you right away. I'll tell you right off. Of course, I'm recording. I'm always recording.
Okay.
This will all be in the show. The Joss Whedon thing. The hating strong women. All that will be. All that will
great.
Be in the show.
Great.
You've heard the show before, right?
No, never.
Your Sasquatch podcast. You do a couple of podcasts. You do Sasquatch. Mm-hmm. You do Ancillary Characters, which is this whole comic book thing.
Yeah.
And you've got like, there's like 16 of you on that show, right? It seems like there's...
I mean, it's at this point, see, it started out and it was just me and my friend Paul. And then we invited a friend of ours on from North Carolina. And then we invited my brother on. So then that was like the regular cast of Ancillary Characters, as it were. But then... the way things are with life right now, people are just on and off the show. So we have, you know, Mark Maskey's been on. We've had you'll have to come on at some point. I mean, we have everyone and anyone on the show. So
I have deep opinions about five things when it comes to comic books. Yeah. But I was going to say your Bigfoot podcast, Sasquatch. How long has that been on the air now?
Just since. I want to say May, but I might be wrong. It might be June. It's 30 episodes in.
You're killing it. I mean, I will tell you, it is my favorite Bigfoot podcast. And
wow.
I make a Bigfoot podcast. And I look forward to yours more than I look forward to mine.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I don't know. I did. It's so weird. I mean, like did you see that Lauren Coleman put us on his top cryptozoology stories of 2014 list? And I was like, what? I mean, I don't even know how we get to that point.
Well, it either means one of two things.
Yeah.
You're really good, and I think you are. Or
we paid him.
Not much happened. Or, oh, yeah, three. You could have paid him, right? Maybe there just wasn't, relatively speaking, you know.
Yeah.
There just wasn't a hell of a lot going on that last year. But, no, I think your show's awesome. And if anyone's listening to this show, if they're not listening to your show, they're doing it all wrong. Then you just start listening to your show.
I don't know. I just don't know how we got, because the first, I mean, if you heard the first two episodes, is literally me talking for like to 10 minutes.
No, I really liked them though. I mean, yeah, totally. I get where you're coming from. Right. And they were, and we'll talk about the problems with your show in a minute.
Yeah, there's a lot.
But the, no, those first ones were kind of cool because they were new and different, right? They weren't like, you know, they sound good, which is always a plus. I can't listen to Bigfoot podcasts that don't sound good. Mm-hmm. But you know, point of view is good. Everyone likes point of view.
I guess. I think those first, you were talking about the shrink thing earlier. I feel like those first episodes are me like trying to work out my own flaws.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like you sort of coming to grips with the fact that you're doing a Bigfoot podcast.
Exactly. I think that's literally exactly what it was. Especially because like at that point we were doing Ancillary Characters pretty hot and heavy. It was I mean, at this point we actually haven't recorded a show in, I think, like a month for Ancillary Characters.
It's been a while. Yeah.
It's been a while. But at that point, it was out every week. I think we were even doing shows occasionally. There were like twice a week, there were shows coming out. And so I just randomly decided. I also do a show with my wife called Pod Pie, but we put it out so irregularly.
Oh, I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, it's out there.
What do you talk about on Pod Pie?
Whatever she wants to talk about. So we have an episode about Mad Men. We have an episode about
awesome.
our wedding, our dog.
But what I've heard is that you have a problem with strong women. So
that,
That's what's going around.
Yeah, it's all over the internet.
It's on Twitter. I read it on Twitter. I don't know. That's all I know.
There goes my career. It's all over. My Bigfooting career.
So we're here ostensibly to talk about the Minerva Monster Project.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get there. So why did you feel the need to add your voice to the Bigfoot podcast universe? That's not a loaded question, you know.
This is the God's honest truth. I wrote a blog post for Sasquatch back when it was just sasquatch.blogspot. No one was reading it. I still don't think anyone reads it, but back when it was just my blog, and I wrote a post about why Bigfoot, like what Bigfoot podcasts need to be doing to set themselves apart. And I think I mentioned a couple that I kind of liked, which was you, the Bigfoot Show, and Sasquatch Chronicles.
Uh-huh.
And but everything else I kind of just threw under the bus. And it wasn't like out of any kind of mean spirit or anything. I just thought that there's so many bad Bigfoot podcasts. People really need to be doing this instead. And then after putting it up, I was like, what the heck? Like, how can I come out and tell people how to do something when I'm not even doing it?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not doing a Bigfoot show. So.
Yeah, it's the sort of the curse of being able to do things is when you realize that you could do something that needs to be done, as far as you're concerned, better, that you almost feel compelled to do it. And Yeah.
So I turned my mixer on one day. I mean, I just sat down at my computer and I didn't know what to do. I was bored. I just turned my mixer on and started talking about Bigfoot. And then I threw that up as I set up like a free account on Podbean. I wasn't even paying for the first like three episodes to upload them.
Is that hard? I mean, I have always thought about doing something, not necessarily around Bigfoot, but what you did is sort of an audio blog post, right? You're just sort of going off, you're talking, it's just you.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there's something very appealing to the freedom of that, but there's also it's something quite scary because you don't know. I mean, at least for me, I don't know what I'm going to say. You know, I don't know. And it's the same thing when I'm writing. I'll start writing with an idea, and more or less I'll follow the track, but I weave all over the place, and I may end up in a spot that I didn't mean to end up in. So it seems to me that like when you're doing that sort of all by yourself thing, you could very easily find yourself in a place that you didn't mean to start.
Yeah, and I think if you are a writer, though, it helps because I would sit down and be like, this episode, I'm going to talk about this. I mean, I only did, two episodes.
Maybe it was three.
I can't remember. I haven't honestly, I don't listen to the show. I listen to it when I'm editing it, and then I try to forget it because I hate the sound of my own voice.
Oh.
So I didn't find it hard because I just would try to stick to one topic. And it's carried over to, you know, Mark Matsky and I doing it, only we're able to bounce things back and forth off of each other. So it's a lot easier. I would almost say that I would do it again with some other topic. I don't know what the topic would be, though, because I did find it kind of fun just to sit and work through my own personal thoughts on things like while recording it.
Right.
But, you know, someone like you, you would kill that. Because you've got intelligence, whereas I'm kind of this rambling mouth.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that maybe that's the way it looks from your side. But a rambling mouth actually masks for a lot of intelligence sometimes. I can, So we're gonna be on the show. We're just gonna say how great the other one is.
That'll be great for all our listeners.
They're very, very like, oh, right, I can't wait for him to like say the other guy is great again.
So this will be yesterday I got a YouTube review for one of the episodes, and it just said this show is terrible. It should have remained. This would have been a boring three-way phone conversation, let alone a recorded podcast.
Man, it seems to me that you get more, well, I was going to say hate mail. Maybe you get more mail.
I
don't know that I've ever had the Bigfoot show reviewed anywhere except like on iTunes.
It's been odd, but we're in
more. You have like a target around your head or something.
I don't know what it is. I really don't, because
that
we don't...
smug attitude that you have.
Do I have that?
No.
I think I might.
Oh, I'm kidding.
I think I might.
Hello, Pod. This is the kettle. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. There's like we've gotten emails, probably 20 or 30 emails by now that are just, even when they're nice, they're like, hey, your show's really good, but please, the crickets are awful.
I love those.
Yeah, well, we get complaints about the crickets a lot, so I kind of removed those. Oh. What else? Someone just wrote me about the length. The length of the show is a real problem.
No, that's it. That I was going to say, the only problem with your show is that they're too short.
Yeah, I just...
I mean, I'm really getting into it. Of course, you know, I'm the guy that puts out four-hour podcasts, but I'm really getting into it. And this one won't be 4 hours. Don't worry. You don't have to clear your evening or anything.
Thank God.
I'm really getting into it. And then it's like, well, that's been another episode of Sasquatch.
Yeah, it's just... I didn't want, like, Ancillary Characters is typically an hour, although lately we've gone to a shorter format, but it was an hour and a half, and we did 2 hour episodes of that show. But I think podcasts right now are actually trending the other way, where they're trying to go shorter, yeah, and it's an easier commute listen for people.
Yeah, I get that.
And when we were talking about, you know, who the show was for, it wasn't for the blog talk radio crowd who want to sit and listen to it for 4 hours. It was, I mean, we welcome that crowd, but it's like we wanted to do something that would be, I just think a person who's just gaining some sort of interest in Bigfoot, mm-hmm, doesn't necessarily want to sit and listen to two guys talk about it for 2 hours.
Well, that's another thing about your show. I think you have a real point of view. I forgot to do something at the top of this show, and we'll come back to this. This is episode number 64 of the show. Episode 64, and at the pace he's going, Seth will eclipse the number of shows that we've put out probably by about the end of February. But anyway, this is episode 64, and it's the 4th of January 2015. It's the first show of 2015. Welcome to a new year. So what I was saying is you have a point of view on your show, which is that you're talking to maybe someone who isn't as steeped in, like, it would be I thought about this because I actually have a friend of mine who started listening to the Bigfoot show with the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really know anything about the subject except that it's, you know, somewhat interesting to him. But he's not, like, seeped in it, right? He has no idea who Melba Ketchum is, for example, or Todd Standing or any of the other cast of monkeys that inhabit this thing.
Yeah.
Like, if you're, like, a casual – you have a casual interest in the subject, or if you aren't, like, soaking in it all day long, the Bigfoot show would be horrible because we don't set anything up. I mean, we just assume that you walk in knowing, like, all these things. But you
don't – You your don't point have of view, to, though.
Yeah, but your point of view is that your listener maybe isn't that.
Exactly. But, like, still, even with – and I hate to go back to, like, kissing your rear end over the Bigfoot show. But the Bigfoot show, the great thing about it is the personalities that are talking about that stuff. So even if I didn't – because when I started listening to the Bigfoot show, I had no clue who Melba Ketchum or any of – thank God – who any of those people were. Uh-huh. And I still found it, you know, hilarious. I mean, Scott alone could do his own show. Like,
don't
Scott.
Say that out loud.
I mean, talking about the PGF.
He doesn't need to hear that. He would talk about. Have you listened to? I think he was the. Was he the second? No, he was the first. When I was doing the Bipcast, he was either one or two. Kathy was one or two, and Scott was the other one or two. I don't remember which order that happened in. But yeah, he will go on that and his own sighting. Anyway, go ahead. You were talking.
His sighting. That's the worst piece of video. I mean, I'm sorry, Scott.
Oh, it's horrible.
Worst piece really of video horrible. I've ever seen of a Bigfoot sighting.
And really hard. You know, I was talking to Phil Pauling about being on the show at one point, and because I suck at this, it fell apart, and he hasn't been on the show yet, obviously, because no one's heard that. And I said, you know, it would be great if you could, like, look at Scott's video and do your thing, you know, because he does that thing that he does so well, I think, when it comes to evaluating these videos.
Right.
But Scott's video is, like, impossible to find online. It's trapped on VHS tapes. It's just not on the internet.
Yeah.
So it's hard for people who haven't seen it to know what you're talking about. But yeah, it isn't great, is it?
See, I can't. Mark and I, when we went to Salt Fork, I think it was, we were talking about this. And then again, I went hiking with a friend last week, and we were talking about Scott's video. And now Mark likes the video, and my other friend who I went hiking with, he said he can't see much there. I literally cannot see anything.
Well,
I see nothing.
Part of the problem is, and he said this on the show, and I didn't mean to turn this into a Scott Harriet love fest, but it's going to anyway. But part of the problem is that it was released onto a program on the History Channel, I think, and they have the wrong part of the video.
Right.
I remember watching that with my wife, like, okay, I want to see this video. I've never seen it before. And I'm looking and I'm like, I don't see anything. Like, I don't see anything, not even a blob squatch. And it's because there literally was nothing to see. They had the wrong bit of video on there.
See,
when,
I wonder,
when you see the real part, you actually can see, like, the side of an animal's head and shoulder, and you can see motion. I mean, there is something there to see, but it's still, you know, it's old VHS tape. It's not, it's probably not first generation what I've seen. So it is, it still isn't a tremendously great video, but it's way better than what's on that History Channel show, which I think they just called Bigfoot. I have it downstairs. It's an interesting show until you get to that part, and then of course they're showing the
wrong. And then it all falls apart.
Yeah, but there's people like you that says I don't see anything whatsoever.
I see nothing.
They must have seen the incorrect bit. Anyway.
It is hearing his account though. It's one of my favorites because I actually really like the where they were.
Totally.
Like he sets that whole story up so well too. Yeah. So.
And I've been there. I've been there without him. I'd like to go back there with him. It's really thick stuff. You know, you can walk right up to the bottom of that hillside, mm-hmm. But then it gets really super dense going up to that tree, which is still there. That tree, which they never cut down because it was damaged by. Let me turn my sound off here. It was damaged by lightning or something. So that tree is still there, and so it's really easy to find that spot.
Can we go off down a rabbit trail for a second?
Yeah, it's my favorite thing.
Undergrowth, like how vital do you think that is to habitat for like these creatures if they're there? Like, do you think it has to be really thick undergrowth in the area for them to be around? Because I always go back to Salt Fork here, which is this famous, you know, supposed Bigfoot location, right? But it's also a state park that really isn't that huge. It's not that big, and there's people crawling all over it. But the undergrowth is so thick that it's totally believable to me that there could be something standing 10 feet away from you. You'd never know.
I think the undergrowth is important for a couple of reasons, and not just for this animal, but for any animal. I think there's a tactical – is that my computer making that beeping noise? Do you hear that? Or is it?
No. Never mind. I hear nothing.
Just on my headphones.
It's okay.
I've said before I don't know what I'm doing.
It's a delusion.
Yeah, that's what it is. it's the Facebook. That's what it is. Let me close Facebook here.
I'm getting notifications right and left right now, so I
think it's important tactically because it gives you if you're let's just assume that these animals hunt and I that is an assumption on my part. I've never seen them do it. They probably could if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. They would need that for stealth, for hiding. I mean, I know that they use it for stealth and hiding. I mean, we obviously have very different experiences in that regard. So my experience tells me that they use it. Tactically to hide and that sort of thing. You would imagine that they would need it to shelter in if they are wanting to be sort of out of sight of not just humans but any other animal. So I think undergrowth is important, but there are places in the country where people have reported sightings where there isn't a large amount of undergrowth. Now, there's probably still little pockets of it here and there. So I think undergrowth is important, and I think that they probably use it to their advantage. I hesitate to say, you know, that there are requirements when it comes to where they would live because I don't know that I know enough. You know, I think we can make some assumptions about water and rainfall and all that kind of stuff that is pretty well known. But mm-hmm. I don't know that there has to be undergrowth. You know, the sightings that happened in the Oklahoma prairies where, you know, that casino video that I did a Bipcast on.
Yeah.
It has patches of undergrowth, but for the most part, it's wide open space. So
that's my favorite Bigfoot photo, by the way.
Yeah, mine too. You know, and there's some speculation. I don't know if this was on Finding Bigfoot or not, but the people who make Finding Bigfoot think now that that's a hoax. But I don't know that the evidence that I've seen that they use to indicate that it's a hoax is not very strong. There's another picture that they say is the same thing, and it's one of those things where you look at it and you either go like, oh yeah, it's totally the same, or you look at it and go like, it's not all the same. So I don't know. But yeah, it's one of my favorite photos as well too, but I also am, you know, fairly well acquainted with the background behind it and all that sort of thing. But yeah,
see, I'm not very well acquainted with that, but I thought the on the NAWAC site, there's the size comparison photos, which are pretty blurry because I think you told me they don't have the... No one had
it's
the
crazy.
Originals.
So the photo was taken on a. I mean, this is like 2000. I think this thing was taken. So it's a really, really early digital camera, mm-hmm. and the file was put onto a tribal computer, like one of the tribe's, you know, civil computers there. Right. And the woman whose computer it was on, as it's been told to me, and this is all second or third hand, it freaked her out that these photos were on there. Because, again, you know, to Native Americans, these are not just apes, right? I mean, there's more to them than that. Yeah. So it kind of freaked her out that these photos were on her computer. So she deleted them. But they had printed them out. So everything that we have now is basically like a scan of a printout of a crappy digital photo from 2000. So we're so far removed from the original files. Wow. But yeah, it's a crazy story. Crazy story.
Yeah, I just think the size of it. I remember the first time I saw the size comparison, I actually got chills because it was. Yeah. I mean, I guess that even if it's not real, just to see because I know a lot of people say that the proportions are similar to what some people have seen.
Right.
It's just crazy to think of something that big, you know, being out there.
Yeah. It is. And then that gets back to like, well, where the hell do they go? And that gets to the, you know, undergrowth question.
Or the dimension hopping.
Or maybe they turn into rabbits. There's also that, the theory. You know, they're not actually warping dimensions, Seth. They're actually like transforming into smaller creatures.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. All right. Cloaking. That's a thing.
Kind of. I mean, if it's sort of a passive cloak, they actually scramble your brain.
My favorite thing about the cloaking idea is that people have. It's like the complete lack of imagination because they will literally describe it as like you'll hear someone say, "Have you seen the movie Predator?"
Right.
That's exactly what it's like.
And you know what? Here's the crazy shit. Again, my experience is it's not unique, but it's different than yours. I can understand where people get that, you know, because they're really, really good at making themselves hard to see, and they're really, really fast, and. They can be super quiet, and I think I talked about this on the last episode. I think you could get yourself to a spot where you start assuming that they're supernatural, based on the things that they just know how to do because they're animals living in the woods.
Yeah,
but anyway, wow, that was a deep little rabbit hole you took.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
No clue what we're talking about.
Cut out the whole thing.
No, I don't edit this. I don't edit this. This is rarely do I edit this.
See, that's the way you should do it though, because I spend my Saturday morning is devoted to editing Sass What, and it takes anywhere from an hour to 3 to 4 hours. I mean, when I first started out, it was like 4 hours editing, and I don't know. You got to find, especially if I'm doing a show where it's clip heavy. You know, where I have to find stuff I want to cut in. Like Mark and I, we want to do a Four Horsemen of Sasquatchery episode.
That'd be good.
But yeah, but I keep thinking when we do that, it's going to take so much background research because I'm going to have to go and find clips of each guy talking. And
you know, it's so much easier just to call up a bunch of your friends and just, you know, shoot the shit for 3 hours.
Right. About comics.
And just throw it out there. You know, that's way easier. That's one of the reasons why I don't do the Bipcast anymore, because it was. If a show was 45 minutes long, there was probably, you know, 12 hours of work that went into that. Not even counting travel and everything else. So those were all like done in the field. So I had to get there. I had to like do all that. I had to edit them down. And I probably didn't edit them down as much as I could. It's a lot of work, these shows. A lot of work. And we're not paid.
No.
I don't know about you. I don't get paid.
Millions, man.
You got t-shirt sales. You got all those t-shirt sales rolling in now.
Oh, yeah. The mad t-shirt dough.
So yeah, where do you think Sasquatch's going?
You still
dig doing it? I mean, is it
Soon? Oh yeah. This year is going to be big. We're going to go. We're planning. You know, right now we're coming up with topics for episodes. Uh-huh. You know, guests. It's hard to do guests, frankly, because there's only so many Bigfoot, quote unquote, personalities.
Totally agree.
And they're on every show.
Right.
So. And it's not anyone's fault. It's just the nature.
It's a small pool, right?
Right. It's a very small community. And so, you know, we got to a point, I think, during October, or maybe it was September, where we had done, I think, 4 interviews in about 5 weeks. And I said to Mark, we're kind of getting away from what I wanted the show to be. Because, you know, like we were talking about, if you were a new person and you were coming into this, you don't know who some of these people are who are, you know, authors or whatever. And it might help to pique your interest. But at the same time, you might not be as likely to check it out if it's just a random name you've never heard of that is guesting on the show. So we're trying to space it out. So like, we did our Kathy Strain episode. I think that was the last interview we did. And
she's a good interview.
Yeah, she's great because and she's a great interview for newbies too. It's the same way with Lyle Blackburn because they're
Lyle's great too.
Yeah, they both kind of have that interesting outlook on things. But I think for now we're just going to do for January. It's going to be topical episodes. I don't have anyone planned out right now to come on the show. I mean, if you want to suggest people, feel free. But for now, it's just this. I just enjoy talking to Mark about, and it is therapeutic in a way because we can work through that. End of year episode was especially therapeutic for me because I hadn't put out my thoughts on the standing.
I haven't heard
Meldrum
that one yet,
thing.
To be perfectly honest with you.
Oh, thanks.
Sorry. You know, Scott never listens to the show.
That's good.
Yeah.
Does he really? He doesn't?
I don't believe he's ever listened to an episode. If he has, he always says, you know, good show at the end. Because clearly he never listens because he says the same things over and over and over again.
Right.
So either that or he's losing his grip on
it. It's true.
Mental faculties.
Well, he's out in the bush, you know, hiking around with no shoes on.
I think he's doing it right now.
See? He has no clue. He doesn't even know what year it is.
But anyway.
Yeah, so I think we're just going to keep pushing forward with topical kind of episodes. We're going to do I do want to get into reading letters on the show because we get letters and we usually read one on an episode and then we kind of move on to whatever the topic is. But I think what we want to start doing is doing like a listener mailbag kind of thing. And the Ohio episodes are big. Like people, for whatever reason, the episodes that we kind of go through Ohio encounters and stuff have been getting probably the most downloads next to interview episodes.
I think it's because Ohio gets sort of a short shrift in the world of Sasquatchery, you know? When I first got into it as an adult, I was stunned to hear about activity in places like Ohio, which to a Southern California bow, Ohio is just a large flat plain of wheat or something, right? I have no concept of what Ohio looks like if I grow up in Southern California.
Right.
But there's so many parts of the country, and I think that's what it is. I think that, and then relatively speaking, you know, a show, and I don't know what your numbers are like, but it's not hard for my show to get a boost if there's some sort of regional interest in it, because then more people in that region can actually sort of swamp it and make it a bigger deal than it would have been normally.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like Mark Dorth from the Ohio Bigfoot Conference. He'll share stuff too if it's Ohio based. And I know he has a pretty big following on Facebook, so we get kickback from that.
Yeah,
but
that always helps.
Yeah. I think Ohio is intriguing too because Ohio's like two different states in one, geographically and everything. You get this very flat. We drove through both versions of the state in the last couple of days because we drove down to Hocking Hills. So Hocking Hills is, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of it, but
only the ones you put on Facebook.
Yeah, it's really unique. It's unique to anywhere. I've been all over the country. It's very unique to any place that I've ever been. It's these big rocky, everything's kind of rocky and deep gorges and high hills and jutting rock and waterfalls and it caves everywhere. And then these just massive cliffs. I mean, cliffs that like we went to some places in the last couple of days that I'd never been to before. And I was stunned. I mean, it was like being out west.
Right.
But we're in Ohio.
Right.
So you get this like very flat farmland in kind of central Ohio and western Ohio. And then you have the rolling hills and, you know, you're in the Appalachian foothills in eastern Ohio. So,
you know, it's exactly the same thing that I found when I started visiting places like Oklahoma and Texas, where you have these media perceptions, right? Because that's what everyone, unless you live there, you have this perception from movies or whatever of what these places are like. And then you get there and you're like, well, the hell, there's mountains in Oklahoma. And I know people in Oklahoma that don't know that. Or you know, East Texas is so not like what you think Texas looks like if you've never been there. But there's places like this all over the country, which is why when you get people say like, what? Bigfoot in Iowa? Like, well, yeah, most of Iowa is corn. I get that. But there are other parts of it that are, you know, slightly terrained and there's, you know, forests and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have mountains, but we have those kind of hollers like you know, in West Virginia. I think that perception too, like you said, it comes from media and all that stuff, but it's because Ohio is always referred to as a Midwest state for some reason.
Right.
And I really don't feel like it is. Like it's nothing like Indiana or Illinois or any of those. There's a tiny portion of the state that is super flat and just you know, rolling endless fields.
Right.
But yeah, the eastern part of the state is very, very wooded, and I mean, you get down into some of those, like Coshocton County, which actually isn't far from Salt Fork, but Coshocton County isn't talked about a lot, and I think that is kind of like the hub of activity in Ohio. It's just right. not. I mean, you talk to the sheriff down in he's retired now, but the guy who is the sheriff in Coshocton County flat out will tell you like he's seen these things, mm-hmm. And he knows they're there. So it's a very very cool, like, former strip mine. Mark and I are actually working on a book kind of sporadically right now because I'm a little busy. But
so let me say, you've got 3 podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a movie that you're mm-hmm. making, and you're yeah. writing a book.
Yeah, we're working on a book. We had a title, but then we found out it was also the title of the Monster Quest episodes. It was going to be Buckeye Bigfoot, and then go through it.
You could use that. They don't have trademark or anything.
We might. We'll see. But it's as of right now, it's kind of on the shelf because we're both a little busy. But
right.
The chapter I was working on when I last sat down was the geography, like kind of the, you know, I was interspersing sightings from around the state that took place in interesting geographical locations that might be indicative of something in that region. So like strip mine sightings and riverside sightings. And it's a really, this state was logged and stripped pretty much almost bare
right
back in the late 1800s and then into the early 1900s, you know, into the early 20th century. And then it there was this reforestation that happened between like late 1930s and then up into the 60s, and you can trace the point where the forest kind of disappears and when it comes back and follow the sightings.
Sure.
Because there's this period of time where sightings go away and then they come back when the reforestation happens. And I didn't really know any of that until Mark and Mark Mazel and Mark DeWorth had told me about the reforestation. I thought that was really fascinating. And I know I'm just rambling, but like, I thought that was really cool because as someone who studies that stuff, I was like, why is there this period of time where there's nothing? I couldn't find anything.
Right.
Yeah.
It's something that, especially, you know, I grew up out west, but in Minnesota where I live now, it's odd when you drive in northern Minnesota and you're driving through the forests there, and I'm sure it's just like this in eastern Ohio, mm-hmm. and you realize that on a sort of a geologic time frame, not that long ago, just a second ago, there was nothing. They clear cut everything as far as the eye could see.
Yeah.
There's so much of the country that's like that.
Yeah,
the what you're looking at is second, third, fourth growth, because Minnesota was sort of like one of the last places where they did that, and then right after Minnesota just missed the cutoff because after that, then this whole conservation effort kind of grew up around places, and they stopped doing it the same way they did it in Ohio and, you know, points east.
What you have there though is like a really interesting piece of evidence for the existence of these things because
right. yeah.
Because if this was just people making up stories, you wouldn't have that correlation. There wouldn't be – I mean, they would just right. be seeing them constantly. There'd just right. be people seeing them. You know, there's one tree in my backyard. I just saw a Bigfoot peek
right.
at it, you
right.
know?
Because if it's just a big joke to everyone, then why would the joke go away?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's also one of the things that I talk about, and this isn't like – hard evidence, but
right.
you know, there's such a consistency to what people see too. Like mm-hmm. they don't get to be 22 feet tall and they're not purple and, you know, they don't have 2 heads and, you know, they don't like exaggerate, you know, they on a purpose, you know, they do the creature does not evolve into something. It's been kind of consistent for as long as I can read reports. It seems like they've been more or less the same. And you would know because you've been looking at a lot of historical reports as well.
Well, I mean, if I can segue here into nice. Into the Minerva.
It's good to be on a show with a professional.
If I could segue here, the Minerva case I thought was very interesting. One of the things that drew me to it was the rocks. And the reason was because of Area X and the episodes of Bigfoot Show where you guys talked about the rock throwing and all that. The first time I read Ron Schaffner's report on the on the Minerva Monster, that was the thing that I thought was the most interesting.
So why don't you step us back a little bit for people who don't know, like me,
okay.
Just give us the sort of the don't give away your whole movie, but give us the sketch of what the Minerva Monster is all about.
Yeah. 1978. I'm actually holding the police report. So Monday, August 21st was the first actual filed police report. This family that lived off the Lincoln Highway out near the town of Minerva in it would be Eastern Stark County, right? Interestingly, it's right in that area where you're starting to leave the flat kind of area and go into that very wooded, hilly section of Ohio. And there are patches of woods through that area. You could probably stay in the wood line and walk from Minerva all the way into Pennsylvania in the woods if you wanted to. Okay. So that's kind of cool. But this family, the Catons, was visited for – it kind of depends. And this is one of those things I don't want to give away, but I probably will anyway. But there were sightings in that area of a strange upright walking creature for at least 8 years. And but this one summer, things kind of blew up, and the Catons were visited multiple times by it. They would actually say that they were followed in the evenings. The kids, there were a lot of kids that lived on this property. Yeah. They would be out playing hide and go seek. They'd have, you know, this thing would be watching them from the wood line. There's a very interesting story that's going to come out in the movie. And if you watch the trailer, there's a little bit about it, but, Howie and a few friends of his were walking around a strip mine. They claim to have actually jumped on the thing, which is like very
physically accosted it.
Yes, literally. Wow. Physically accosted it. One of them was bit. There's police photos somewhere of the bite marks. But this police report was filed because there was one particular night where they were at the Caton's home. And this creature came up to the house, kind of scared them. They all went inside the house. Uh-huh. And it actually came up to the window and was looking in at them. And so you're talking about maybe a 9-foot, you know, space between them. And they could clearly identify this was not a bear. It wasn't, you know, anything normal to the area. They filed the police report. The Akron Beacon Journal picked up the story. It took off. It became pretty much a massive media thing in Ohio especially, but it went global because there was a news station from Germany here and Asia.
Okay.
So we had some sort of Japanese TV channel did a story on it. And the sightings got so big that, you know, scores of hunters started showing up in their front lawn and heading out into the woods with beer and shotguns, looking to kill one of these things. And it just turned into this really interesting series of events that kept unfolding over the course of about a week, but it was an ongoing thing. I mean, for the family, it was an ongoing for years sort of event. For the town and for the media attention, it was really about the course of 1 week. But it really seemed to capture the imagination of a lot of Bigfoot investigators, guys like Matt Moneymaker and Robert W. Morgan and Don Keating, our local Bigfoot guy here. They were at the house there. Moneymaker staked out at the house, according to Howie, many times, like just stayed overnight and kind of sat. And the way Howie Caton put it to me is that these guys actually became obsessed with coming to their house and looking for it. And eventually it got to a point where Howie kind of told him, you can't come here anymore.
I don't know anything about that. I couldn't possibly comment on that. It sounds a lot like what happened down in Fauk. You know, there seems to be a lot of similarities. You know, it's of course several years later. But it's also sort of right in the heart of that sort of, I'm not going to say first wave, but you know, when I was a kid, in the 70s and Bigfoot was sort of culturally everywhere. It just sort of seems to be right in the hot spot of all of that.
Right. This particular movie that we're working on, as of now, this is our big focus, but there's a larger, idea in place, which is to do sort of a series of these kind of little documentaries and call them Small Town Monsters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like you're saying, about Falk. Well, there's way more than, I mean, right. you know this, but right. there's way more than just Falk. It's like every state has multiple. I mean, Ohio has, within 3 miles of me, I have a little town called River Styx, like the Greek, you know.
Wow. Dead.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Is there a boatman and everything?
You know why they called it the River Styx is because there was a river that ran into what the historical record claims was a dense, impenetrable swamp inhabited by black bear, rattlesnake, and cougar. Huh. And so they called the town River Styx because it was this right on the banks of this, you know, right. huge, vast swamp. But in the 70s and up until the early 2000s, there were sightings of what people called the River Styx monster. Monroe, Michigan has one of my favorites, the Monroe monster, which mm-hmm. is this story that went on for months and had people getting shot in the leg because they thought thought it was a Bigfoot. And it was going back and forth between being a hoax and not being a hoax because kids were found running around in this
right.
ape costume.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I'm kind of getting off track here, but they're all over, like these reports of, you know, sightings that eventually seep into the fabric of that community. And it inform, like, Falk has embraced it. And that's the great thing about Falk.
Totally.
Minerva has not embraced their Bigfoot.
I was
even
gonna
though,
ask you, so if you go to Minerva, is there going to be like any signage or anything like that that sort of nothing. Gets behind it? So you would have no clue if you went in there.
You would not know. And it's one of the questions I started asking people when we were interviewing them for the documentary was, is this an important story to be told? And is it something you want to be remembered and why? And everyone had a different take on it, but everyone almost unanimously agreed it's worth telling, it's worth remembering, it's worth being documented. But if you talk to locals in Minerva today, unless they're old, like elderly people, mm-hmm. no one has a clue what we're talking about.
Right. Wow.
Which to me is a shame because it's like any piece of history. You know, it doesn't matter if it even happened as the people that claimed
right.
it, you know, happened, if it actually happened that way. But it's something that informs what that town is and informs its history. And I just find that depressing that that so many younger people in that town have no clue what the Minerva monster even is. So
is there still a lot of reported activity or any reported activity around there, or has it pretty much all died away?
So, yeah, Minerva is only, I mean, I would say 20, 25 minutes from Salt Fork, which is, you know, the hub, supposedly. Uh-huh. It's probably 35, 40 minutes from Coshocton County. You're right near. I mean, there's constant reports in that section of the state. In terms of in Minerva itself, there may or may not still be activity to today on the Catons property.
Mm.
I mean, that
so
may
they're
or may
still
not.
There.
It's a possibility. Yeah.
I guess we'll find out when we see the movie.
I have been in the woods behind the house. We got to go up the – so behind the house, let me explain what the house is to you because you're going to find this interesting because of Area X. Uh-huh. So if you look behind their house, it's a formerly strip mined – in that section of Ohio, there's just these big mounds, like these hills that look like huge mounds that come up out of the ground, out of nowhere. And they live with one of these mounds, like these huge hills behind their house. And there's kind of a steep cliff down towards their, you know, towards the back of their house. And their house actually juts up against the hill to where if you wanted to, you could walk onto their roof off the hill.
Wow.
So what really started the activity is that they would hear rocks coming off the hill onto the house at night. And keep in mind, this is back in, this actually would have been more like 74, I think, because it was, he said, you know, he told us it was 3-4 years before they actually even filed a report. So they would hear these rocks coming down. Rocks were constantly being thrown at their house. And he said one time they were out there and they decided, you know, they would throw a rock up into the woods and the rock would come back at them.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I don't know anything about that.
You don't know anything.
I've never
about
heard
that.
Anything like that in my life. Yeah,
crazy, right? So what they started doing is marking the rocks. They would take a marker and they'd mark the rock and throw it up into the woods and the rock would come back at them. And they'd have the mark on the, you know, on the rock. And at night they'd mark rocks. They'd mark all these rocks, chuck them up into the woods. If they didn't come back, they'd go to bed. In the morning they'd come out, you know, they'd hear the rocks hitting the back of the the house. They'd come out in the morning, and the rocks would be all over the house with the marking on them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they described all the classic Bigfoot things, you know, the strange smells. They referred to it as a sulfur smell, and that's actually backed up by the sheriff who investigated the sightings. James Shannon is his name. He said when he showed up at their house after they filed the police report, there was a strong sulfur smell, and it was all over the area behind the house. But that rock thing, the first time I heard that rock thing, the first thing I thought of was Area X.
Yeah.
Because that just put me in mind of that. And again, that's one of those, you know, things you hear that run across not all, but a lot of Bigfoot reports, you know, that is obviously some sort of characteristic personality thing they get into.
That's really interesting. So what was their, how long had they been on the property at this point?
You know, we asked him this question and it's on camera and I cannot remember. Okay. I don't think it was a great period of time, you know, maybe just a few years.
Right, right.
Now we do have a guy we talked to, and he's in the movie, and he talked about possible sightings all the way back in the 50s.
Right.
But one thing to keep in mind for that area is there are black bear. The ODNR denies it, but there were black bear sightings in that area around the same time. So we'll go into all that in the movie too, because I didn't want to just, you know, lay out one possible, you know, explanation for it. But there were black bear sightings. But yeah, as far as I know, they hadn't been there very long. Right. I really want to say like 4 or 5 years.
Well, it's one of those things you want to know, like. Did it just start? Had they been on the property for 50 years, right? And then all of a sudden it starts, or had they just shown up, or, you know, it's that sort of thing. And then there was another question I had. Oh, so to the extent that they were aware of Bigfoot prior to this happening, like when do you think they made those connections between what was happening and possibly a monster in the forest?
They had no clue what Bigfoot was. And this is according to Howie and from talking to his sister, Rebecca, who we did not manage to get on camera, but she told me the family had no idea of what a Bigfoot would be. So she said that what Howie said is that they just thought it was some old man living in the woods.
Right.
Like they used to call him the old man in the woods.
Yeah.
And And they'd never, you know, there was no Bigfoot to them. They I don't even think that came in. If I remember right, that didn't come onto the, you know, for them, that didn't even come into the picture until maybe Robert W. Morgan or Ron Schaffner started coming around.
I don't think it's unusual for people who are in situations like theirs to not draw the line to Bigfoot, and it's the investigators that do it for them.
You know, right.
They never say the word Bigfoot or anything, you know, until someone does it for them. That's interesting. So no, go ahead.
One other X correlation here is there were sightings of two quadrupedal animals alongside this purported Bigfoot. So I thought that was an interesting thing. Now, what early reports like Ron Schaffner's initial reports, which you can read on BFRO's website, he refers to them as, and I think the family themselves might have done it as well, but panthers. Uh-huh. But you know, you got to think it's dark, it's nighttime. They're seeing two animals, right. You know, probably black in color, flanking this thing. Their thinking was cats. But when I heard that, yeah, the first thing I thought of was those. You know, the reports out of X of those quadrupedal juveniles.
The quadrupeds or the extreme sort of like bent over 45-degree kind of position that might actually look quadrupedal in the dark. I remember, this is ringing a bell. I remember in the very early days of the Bigfoot forums, a sort of lengthy conversation about whether or not wood apes could have like sidekick animals. And I remember them talking about a report. It could have been this one. It was a BFRO report.
Probably was.
It could have been that one saying, well, like, you know, there's this report out of Ohio or wherever it was. I mean,
Panthers.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got pet panthers or whatever.
Yeah, and a lot of people still talk about it that way. Like, it had these two pet panthers that it was obviously protective of, and
right.
And which is, I mean,
did they,
I guess
did they have collars. I mean, if they weren't collars, yeah. I mean, anybody's.
It had them on leashes. but yeah, I the first time I heard this report and heard that aspect of it, I thought that was very odd. And then yeah. I started hearing, you know, kind of the stuff out of X. And I know I've heard other juvenile reports where people saw them walking, you know, on yeah. all fours.
Yeah.
And I thought that that could be a better explanation for it. The other, obviously, the other explanation would be that it could have been a black bear with two cubs.
Right.
But I the reason I don't give much credence to the black bear in this particular scenario with the Catons anyway. The reason I don't give a ton of credence to that is because I, you know, personally asked Howie, I talked to Rebecca. They both saw this thing feet away from them. I mean, 9-10 feet.
Right.
Through a window, clear as day, could not be a black bear, according to Howie. And I believe him.
And the sidekick thing, the feline, you know, the there is based on my experience and what I've heard people I know well when they've described it, I would say there is almost a feline quality to their motion in that it's very, you know, felines have this economy of motion, you know, they sort of glide when they move around mm-hmm. and they don't, like bears have a very distinctive sort of like bumpy cadence, you know, they're just sort of like galumphing around, you know, you don't really think of a bear as being extraordinarily agile or sleek.
Right.
But you know, when you see, and I'm thinking of the sighting when they ran up the hills, the experience that I had, to the extent that I saw what I saw, it was incredibly smooth, and mm-hmm. and I could see someone saying, you know, thinking cat just because of the, you know, the sort of the grace with which they can traverse open land. So that's fascinating. I mean, what, yeah. So how far along are you on this project?
So the filming's completely done, as we hope. I mean, I've never made a documentary, in all honesty. I've done, you know, journalism for newspapers, so I have an idea of how to tell a story and how to do interviews and how to track down witnesses and things like that. And Alan and Jesse, who are working with me on the project, Jesse Morgan and Alan McGargle, I always forget how to pronounce his last name. Alan has edited and done all that sort of stuff before, so thankfully he's in charge of all that. And Jesse is pretty much handling anything in terms of like PR and running the social media stuff. Uh-huh. We are into editing. As of right now, we've got a good chunk of the movie already edited in rough form, so we still got to work on that. The big plan, obviously, is, you know, it's supposed to premiere at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference in May. And then it should possibly be available on DVD and streaming and all that stuff right around that same time. So as of right now, I think we're moving along at pretty much as scheduled. It's just a matter of kind of piecing things together, because I'll tell you what I didn't want it to be is I didn't want it to be like every other Bigfoot documentary, right, or every episode, right, of Monster Quest. I didn't want it to be dramatized. I didn't want us to do any reenactments, any of that stuff. I didn't want to have a narrator, because frankly, I'm a big documentary fan. My favorite documentaries don't have narrators.
I was going to ask you, so you're not doing any voiceover or anything? You're just
nothing,
letting
no.
the video tell a story?
Yeah, the people talking are telling a story. And what that means, though, which was a little bit of a learning curve for us, is you have to have...
They've got to say it all.
They have to have everything.
Right.
So we have to have... And it's got to play out naturally. And thankfully, Alan's editing is pretty unbelievable, because he's putting it together kind of seamlessly. And he's doing it based off of like kind of vague notes from me. Mm-hmm. Like I want this to go into this, and this needs to go here. And, you know, we have to lay out, you know, the location of the state needs to be... I mean, we had thought we had finished back at the end of November in terms of filming, and ended up going back out to Minerva for an entire day of shooting, which we hadn't done since probably our first weekend shooting. We set up at the Historical Society. We had the mayor come in. We had local historians come in. And their main job was to tell us just the most basics. Like, they had to have thought it was
bits,
ridiculous.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
It's like, okay, geographically, where is this? You know, I mean, just simple stuff. And you had to have all that because otherwise it's not going to play out right, you know, when people are watching it. They've got to have that information in front of them.
If you don't have Leonard Nimoy to connect the dots for you, it's really
exactly.
Not, you got to have, like, Nimoy.
Well, that's why we left out the entire...
Or Stacey Keach. Right.
There's
right.
No way to... I don't even know who Stacey Keach is.
What?
Is that... Yeah, I had no clue.
How old are
Sorry.
You?
Sorry. I'm young.
Punk.
I'm really old, actually. But,
well,
yeah,
I'm excited about this because I, you know, the what I think is most interesting, and maybe I'm weird. I don't think so because I think you think the same way. But what's most interesting about this stuff, you know, these accounts and the experiences of people are the actual experiences of the people. And
yeah.
When you start to put all the theater around it,
yep.
You know, like even finding Bigfoot, the best part about finding Bigfoot is when they're talking to the witnesses. Absolutely
yeah.
The best part. And that's, I don't need the, you know, the stupid ass computer generated monkey guy jumping into the woods. I want to see what they're telling me.
Yeah.
And very often your graphics to them, obviously very much so, but the graphics just take away from that. So I really like the idea of you just telling the story and letting the people tell the story as it happened to them. That's very appealing to me.
Yeah, what I said to Alan and Jesse is we need to be the response. Like, everyone's been saying this that's involved in this subject for a long time,
right.
Is these, you know, if they just did this,
right.
It would be better.
Right.
Well, no one's doing it. It's the same concept as me going out and recording Sasquatch.
See what I'm saying? Once you say that something should be a certain way and you know how to do it, you're almost obligated to do it.
You just have to do it. So, I mean, we're going to give it a shot. And I think it's going to play out exactly how we all have been saying this sort of thing would work. It is the definition of an indie film, too, because it's basically been three or four buddies doing this. You know, we go out, we track down the people. Here's the crazy thing. Howie Caton has never done an interview that I'm aware of. I could not find a quote from him. I haven't found. He turned down people that you wouldn't believe that have offered to put him in, you know, documentaries and stuff. They never would go along with it. It took me four or five phone calls talking to him just to get him to a point where I could even ask him if he would be willing to. And at that point, there was still more. With the day we got to their house to shoot his interview, he said, "I changed my mind." That was the first thing he said to me when I got out of the car. And it took another probably 20 minutes of me and his wife working on him to get him to go along with it. And we never could get, you know, Rebecca to come on camera to talk about it, which is a shame because her retelling of the story almost had me in tears. Because it sounds weird, but I'm emotionally invested in this story. I became fascinated with it around probably November last year and started actively calling people and trying to get in touch with people who were involved with the story last January. Before I even knew this was going to be a movie, it was just kind of going to be, I think at that point it was going to be a book is what I kind of wanted to do with it. And the first time I got a hold of Rebecca and she was telling me the story from her point of view, she said things to me too that we will never get on camera, which stinks because she told me one of the really fascinating things that isn't in the movie, and I'm sad it isn't because it would have been such a cool little aspect to it, but she was convinced that the creature was somehow attracted to her mother because her mom was apparently really sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she died not long after the events that took place. She told me that the creature would, anytime their mom was outside, it was outside. They just would know it would be there. She'd be gardening. They knew it was going to be outside. And then when her mom died, the way Rebecca told it was at that point, it wasn't there anymore. Which I just find that whole... I mean, it kind of runs up against what Howie's telling us and what the other Catons are telling us as far as like ongoing activity. But
right.
It's such a, it, to me, that's the kind of thing I love because that's interesting that her perception of it is that this creature was there because of her mother.
Right.
And right.
There's a whole package there to get into, you know.
Right.
The connection between her sick and now deceased mother and this mm-hmm. crazy stuff going on. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And there was there was some other stuff. Like I talked about it a little on another show I was on where
what? You've done another show?
Yeah, there was another show I was on where where so the police officer James Shannon said that there was like a UFO sighting across the street in the same 2 week period. And you know, my reaction to that is it's not at all surprising because of the fact that there were all these hunters running around those woods.
Right.
I guarantee there was all sorts of crazy stuff going on.
Right.
You know, guys up in the woods with lights and lanterns and
up in the trees,
firing guns drunk. And I mean, it's the things that surround the story that I find so, so interesting. The hunter aspect of it alone is really funny.
Uh-huh.
To me, because
you've got any of those guys. Did you find any of them?
We have one interview with a guy whose dad was out there around the same time. But front page articles of the Akron Beacon Journal about the story has a picture of a man armed with a rifle, and you know, wearing a T-shirt, wandering out into the woods behind their house. It says Bigfoot Hunter. You know, I mean, and you got to think of for the Catons. This is their home, right?
Absolutely.
And
right.
All of a sudden, Howie said one day he woke up and their front yard was full of cars. Man. I mean, just people parking in their yard and going up into the woods. And he told us that the last 2 years he would have been a sophomore, I think, the year that all this happened. He said his last 2 years of high school was a nightmare because the family was pretty much tormented by a lot of the people in the town over this thing because, you know, they became the Bigfoot people, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, like, they would go to football games and the crowd started chanting Bigfoot at them. And the local restaurants put Bigfoot Eats Here, you know, and, like, all this kind of stuff. And they took it very personally because to them, this was just something that, you know, that was going on behind their house that they felt they needed help with.
Right.
And when they reported it, it became this just huge laughing stock. I mean,
So you wonder, there's so much stuff there. This, you know, and I can tie this right back to X. Why do the people who own the property in X not want us to confirm or deny where it is? Because they don't want that, right? They don't. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to get to. It isn't like it's a house on a street, but they don't want that. Why would you bother even telling people this was happening to you if you were in another part of the country, right? This is why. And so why don't people say that they've got long-term activity on their property? This is exactly why they don't want to deal with the crap. They don't want to deal with being, you know, made fun of, and they certainly don't want a yard full of hunters showing up overnight. That's rough stuff right there.
And it's so fascinating that the town has just let it slip away.
Yeah, it's gone.
Right, and to me, it's like, man. One of the we interviewed a man named Roger Bartley, and he's kind of the local historian, and there's a very interesting history involved with the town as well, where there was this lost French gold, and supposedly at one time Minerva was known as the lost French gold town, and some treasure hunters go out there all the time and they're looking for this gold and stuff, you know. So, you know, to him, that's a really cool part of the local history. And
right.
It should, you know, they had a lost French gold festival for years and they don't anymore. But, you know, I asked him, well, why is this, you know, I asked him that question. Why is this story important to the town? And he basically had the same response that I do, which is not only should it be captured and preserved as part of the town, you know, the history of that town, but it would be an awesome way to bring in revenue.
Totally.
For a town that is, you know, a small town, all the little local independent businesses are gone.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Walmart down the street.
Right.
You've got, you know, I mean, it's this is happening all across the country.
Bigfoot Days, D-A-Z-E. I can just see it. It's in June. It's, you know, exactly right. I mean, look at what they do down in Falk, right?
Same exactly.
Deal. Same deal.
Same thing. Bring in, the only thing is, I mean, I get that what his thinking is, they're thinking, well, this is going to bring in a certain type of people, but it's not true anymore.
Do you think it's a regional, maybe cultural, Are the folk who live in Ohio just a different stock of people? And I'm not saying that you know, I just think that it's I think there are parts of the country where this sort of thing like would be more acceptable to mm-hmm. the people who live there. Like, I can't imagine this happening in Minnesota, for example, but it's really common all over the Pacific Northwest, and down in Oklahoma, it's just part of the, it's not even like a thing. It's like everybody knows. Right. So I just wonder if there's like a cultural reason why they would fail to embrace it.
It's possible. Another, I mean, it could be an age thing is the other thing.
Sure.
Because I know that, and this is no knock against the town of Minerva because I absolutely love it. I actually grew up 20 minutes from Minerva. I was there constantly. My sister bought her wedding dress there at the bridal shop. I used to eat there with my family every Friday night. I love Minerva. But it's a town that is generally run by older, you know, I'm talking 70, 80 years old people. Yeah. The historical society is entirely volunteers, and unfortunately, younger people aren't volunteering to, you know, keep the history of the town alive. And in talking to one of our interview subjects, he told us we don't want anything preserved that we cannot verify. So these people are claiming they saw a Bigfoot. Well, how's that different from someone claiming they saw Frankenstein behind their house? You know, and then we put up a plaque or something about that. Well, then you're just manufacturing history. Right. Well, not. I mean, I think it's an age thing. I don't know that it is regional. I think Minerva is run by older, you know, older people with an older way of thinking. There is a difference between people just making anything up and what happened in Minerva. Minerva was documented. It was on TV. It was in the newspaper.
Whether the distinction right there.
Right. Whether or not these people actually saw something honestly doesn't even matter anymore. It's a part of that town, mm-hmm. and it's a part of the folklore of the town and the history of the town, and it deserves to be preserved.
It's kind of like Area 51. Not Area 51. I'm sorry.
Roswell.
Roswell. Exactly. Yeah. It's just like Roswell. It doesn't matter what that thing was. It fell to the ground.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, totally.
Exact same thing.
So how did you hook up the guys that you're making this thing with? They already were they already a production company? Were they already doing things? Or
no, they run a – okay, so Fathom Frontiers, they run Fathom Frontiers, which is kind of an outdoor adventure thing. They do a event called Bigfoot Adventure Weekends, which they kind of take families and couples out in the woods in the summer, and they kind of teach them survival stuff, and it's really cool. It's actually one of the few Bigfoot related things that I think is kind of cool, because you're not just paying for someone to show you a, you know, fake Bigfoot site. You're actually, you know, kind of a weekend getaway with your family kind of thing. They do that. They run all the sound equipment and everything for the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, which is I think I'm actually going to have to help them this year. It is a chore, because when you're talking like multiple speakers, they run video now. There's a room upstairs at the conference center, because there's so many people that go that they can't even fit everyone in one room. So they have a room upstairs where people watch it via teleconference, basically.
Wow.
On a big screen. So they run all that stuff. They do YouTube videos, not many, although I was in their last two, I think. And then they run a company called Grassman Gear, which sells like Bigfoot t-shirts and that kind of stuff. So we got hooked up because I met them at the conference, and then I wanted someone on the show on Sasquatch. I wanted to do an episode of Sasquatch where I actually went out in the woods with someone. And Alan and Jesse actually have a sense of humor about stuff, and they're not quite as intense as some Bigfoot people from this area can be.
Yeah.
That was the best way I could put that.
That's very diplomatic.
Yeah. So we went out and we were just kind of talking about their experiences. You know, they're very skeptical and rational when it comes to this stuff too.
That's too bad.
Yeah. So I kind of like that. And then we got to talking about, you know, I saw all the camera equipment and sound equipment and everything they had when we were out. And I was like, you know, I've been wanting to do a movie about Ohio Bigfoot for a long time. And they were like, we'd love that. They were like, why don't we just sit down, you know, go out for dinner, have a meeting, talk about it. And as we were walking back to the car, I mentioned Minerva, and I said it would be cool to kind of do a series, because I told them about my small town monsters idea, which is something that I've had in the works for ages. And they loved it. They were like, let's do it. But at that point, though, it became how the heck do we do this? Because you have to track down. See, the thing is, this happened in 78, right? So Evelyn Caton, who was the mother, she was 55 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else was in their 30s or, you know, 40s. So a lot of these people are gone, dead and gone. Witnesses from the town. See, there were sightings. There's a trailer park maybe 400 yards from the Caton's house. There were rocks thrown into that trailer park for months, and people there saw the thing. There's BFRO reports that I've seen from around that area. There's an undocumented report that the sheriff, I want to say, told us about. People anonymously called the police department. They were in a car. This unmarried couple was in a, actually they were married, just not to each other. They were in a car back on this abandoned gravel road that runs up behind the trailer park and into the woods, right by this big quarry pond. And, they were in the car, and the thing apparently came up, started shaking the car, and they reported that anonymously. And so, I mean, there was a lot of different witnesses that saw stuff, but they were mostly gone because this happened, you know, quite a while ago. So we had to set out to actually track people down, and it was that would have been from June all the way up until late September when we finally went out and started filming. I was making calls and tracking down the the sheriff was flabbergasted by the fact that I had somehow come up with his number, and I couldn't even explain to him how I'd come up with his number. I somehow found his number on like a New York City Fire Department website.
The internet, man.
Yeah,
it's where'd crazy. You get this number?
I don't know.
Yeah, he's the coolest, man. He was the. I'll tell you right now, I could make an entire movie about James Shannon's life. He spent probably an hour just telling us like crazy stories about stuff he investigated in the 70s. You know, like there were all these weird like people hanging themselves and asphyxiation deaths and. Like just an hour listening to this old sheriff tell us this stuff.
I've sat around the fire with like, you know, retired EMT guys, retired paramedics, sheriff's deputies, you know, and they will just start trying to one up each other with the crazy stuff. And then you just have to walk away.
Yeah.
Like you can't even like, I can't hear this anymore. And like, they're just like, they're like getting off on it. Right. Cause no, there's one time this crazy guy. And it's like, no, I got to leave. I can't. Anymore.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was. His wife was like trying to shut him up.
Like, stop saying these things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you're ever in the woods with Bob Strain, do not get him going. He will absolutely just, you'll just be grossed out by all of humanity.
Oh, great. Yeah. I can't wait.
Anyway. So you're coming out in May, you think? That's your target.
Target is May. Yeah. And there's a soft, not soft. The plan is to do a Kickstarter. To actually get the you know,
900,000 is what I hear the going rate is on Kickstarter.
Exactly. 900,000 for the Minerva Monster movie.
In US, though, it could be a little less, maybe 850.
Yeah. Oh, 700 tops. but yeah, there is a plan to do it like a Kickstarter, and we've got some really cool stuff worked out with that. It's just a matter of whether or not we're gonna do it. I haven't it's not 100%. I'd say we're at like 90% right now.
Well, it's one of these things, though. You're going to come out anyway. So the
It's coming out regardless. The Kickstarter thing is just to offset, would be to offset the initial publication costs of putting out DVDs, you know?
Right, right.
So it's interesting. It's an interesting time for making movies. It's like, I don't know if Eduardo said this to us when actually on the show or afterward, but I was talking to him about Minerva Monster. And Eduardo Sanchez, the director of Exists, he told me you're it's
nice
an ideal
drop,
time.
It's good,
right?
Name drop.
Right. Sorry, he said it's an ideal time because you've got Kickstarter, you've got YouTube.
Right.
If you want to build an audience, you just put it out there and let it get consumed.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't, and I've been kind of pushing that as well. Like, it'd be great to sell some DVDs, but there's an audience out there for this kind of movie. There really is. And I just want to tap into that audience. I want people to be able to see a story like this told from the perspective of the people who lived it. And it's to show people that, you know, make shows like Mountain Monsters,
right,
that you don't have to do it that way. You can do an honest representation of this event, and it will be just as dramatic, just as interesting as having a bunch of drunken yahoos running around in the woods shooting at each other.
Well, it'll be differently interesting.
Right. There's... That's true. It might not be as fun to watch if you're drunk, but...
Right. Well, I'm super excited. I mean, I've been excited about this since you know, I first heard about it, however it is that I heard about it, but I can't wait. I can't wait to see this.
Yeah.
And I expect that most people listening to this show are probably thinking about it the same way we are, that it'd be nice to see this kind of a retelling of an event.
Yeah. So, yeah, I hope so. Go to, if I can pimp it real quick, the please. Facebook page is facebook.com/MinervaMonster. If you search it, you can just search Small Town Monsters. I think we're actually listed under Small Town Monsters. But either way, you can find it on Facebook and give us a like, and anything you see on there you want to share that helps us spread the word. We are not a big time production, so pretty much this is entirely word of mouth.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show. I wanted to have you on for a long time. I'm just trying, you know, we're an hour and 20 minutes, so this is like 3 Saswat episodes.
Oh man. Yeah. Mark and I, and we're recording later today, so I guarantee in this amount of time we will have recorded 3.
Okay, well, I will I'll do my best to get this out in the next day or so, but thanks so much for being on, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, I saw the thing coming out of the sky. It had a one long horn and one big eye. I commenced to shaking and I said, ooh-wee. It looked like a purple people eater to me. It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. A one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. Sure looked strange to me. Oh, well, he came down to earth and he lit in a tree. I said, Mr. Purple People Eater, don't eat me. I heard him say in a voice so gruff,
I wouldn't eat you, cause you're so tough.
It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. One